You're about to enter Nowhere, California.
If you like what you hear, please search for us on iTunes. Look at Nowhere, California, all one word. You can also find us on Facebook.com/Nowhere, California. Please hit like.
And as always, we are very hungry for your feedback. So if you have any requests or anything like that, please send your love, your hate, or your apathy to Nowhere_California@yahoo.com.
This is your next installment of Why Not? As always, if you have not seen the movie that we are about to discuss, which is the 1991 classic, The Fisher King, go watch it now. We'll wait. We don't want to ruin anything for you. And if you haven't watched it yet, you should be kind of ashamed of yourself. So go watch The Fisher King, enjoy the movie, come back, and listen to us talk about it. This is Josh.
And this is Phil.
And as the opening told you, this is Why Not The Fisher King.
Yeah.
As we told you after our little raking across the coals of Street Fighter, the rest of this year will be all Robin Williams Why Nots, because this is our show.
It is. And the thing is, what we want to remind everybody here is a lot of people have a tendency, and this is, you know, no different with Robin Williams, which I've kind of found astounding, is that when a person passes, people sometimes focus on the way we lost that person.
Yeah.
And we sometimes forget what an incredible and wonderful individual they were.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, as far as I'm concerned, still are. Like Elvis exactly. Presley. Elvis Presley is still going to be the king of rock.
Exactly. And also, too, there a lot of things happen with actors when they pass away. Their more mainstream
exactly.
work is focused on, and then there's stuff that gets lost in the shuffle.
It is.
And that's kind of one of the main reasons we chose Fisher King as the first one we're going to hit, because I will honestly admit it. I did not see the Fisher King until after Robin's passing. And I'm still freaking ashamed of it.
You know, the thing is, you know, normally I would give you so much grief, and I know I do.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, dude, how do you miss Big Trouble in Little China? But you know what? You got to take a look at Robin Williams' body of work. And there is a lot of amazing stuff that I haven't seen.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen, I think, The World According to Garp. I have been told about that.
Oh, wow.
I'm meaning to see it, but I still haven't seen it. But he has left an incredible body of work, and I am going to enjoy that one of these days.
Oh, yeah.
It's on my bucket list.
We will be hitting that in these series of Why Nots, because...
Oh, cool.
Like you, there's a lot of people that know of The World According to Garp, but go, nah.
No.
But World According to Garp was his first... Like, one of his first big shots at stretching his bounds.
Yeah.
Like, people... Like, Popeye was his first movie.
Oh, yeah.
It was a stretch for him and everything, but still, it was a goofy role and everything.
Yeah.
But The World According to Garp was comedic, but also had a lot of drama in it.
Oh, absolutely.
And the same thing goes with The Fisher King.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one thing I was really ashamed about when I finished watching it. It's like, all this
when
movie...
When you realized how funny it was.
How funny it was, but also, too, how right up the alley it was for me.
Oh,
like,
really?
How I like those type of movies.
You do. And the thing is, who better to convey it than Robin Williams?
Oh, exactly.
The man. Oh. This is one of those things. I saw it when I was a tot. You know, I'm the same...
When you probably shouldn't have.
Well, no, the thing is, no. My folks, you know, it's kind of
well, you
like,
got the good folks where, like, if there was something where you're, like, start chasing somebody around with a big-ass knife going, this is my sword!
Oh, yeah, no. No, the thing is,
or,
I mean, it's like, you know,
they find you in the park naked.
Oh, right, exactly. Oh, that one was odd. No.
That was before Fisher King.
Yeah, exactly. I probably would have done that when I was 5.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wasn't into doing that. All I see is, oh, look, Mork's being silly.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I couldn't convey, you know... I didn't look at movies the same way I do now. I look at it and I'm like, oh, yeah, oh, I love the funny parts, but, you know, a lot of the story got lost to me.
Yeah.
But, man, I can really... I reread the synopsis. Like I said, I didn't exactly refresh for this movie, but I read the synopsis to it, and I just... You want to know what I was thinking to myself? Holy shit, why the hell isn't this in my video library?
Yeah.
Because it is... it's a traditional Robin Williams thing.
Well, I bought it... after he passed away, I went on that jag of just... buying Robin movies left and right.
Oh, you got to, because they're going to go up in value.
They're going to go up in value, but also, too, I kind of had that reverse effect like all you guys had, where you're kind of like, I'm not ready to watch this stuff yet. I wasn't wanting to stop.
No!
And it didn't really get obsessive, but it was just like, And if I stop, I don't know how I'm going to react.
Well, exactly. It was just painful. Yeah. You know, the problem is the same thing with Harold. Granted, it's like I wasn't going to stop watching Ghostbusters.
Yeah. But you needed to take the pause.
I did have to, but I still watch it. And I still watch it. And I'm like, God, I wish you were still with us. And that's what I do with Robin now.
Yeah.
I'm like, God, I wish you were still with us. Same thing with all the other greats, Rodney Dangerfield, stuff like that. You know, John Candy. There are just many greats that I wish you were still there, but you know what? I do love their body of work,
yeah.
And they will always be there.
And like,
and Robin is no exception. God, yeah, I'm looking at his credits, right?
Yeah.
There's 102 credits.
And we're going to be cramming in as much as we can when we do these why nots.
Oh, I know. We're aiming for the obscure because these are the ones that we say...
why not this?
Why not? Yeah.
Why not the Fisher King?
If you are not familiar with his body of work, you really got to check this out.
Yeah.
You know, and this was a pretty good stretch for him. And 1991 was a big year because you want to know what he did after this? Hook.
Yeah.
And that was really
good.
Two
flips of the coins.
It is, and he was really fun writing that. He would do something that was okay. Here's something for the Academy. Here's something for the kids.
Yeah.
You know, and Peter Pan, him revisiting that, and he can do that. And you know, there are so many artists that will do something, and then you know, I'm never gonna return to this again.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna do anything that's kid friendly or anything like that. They go, it's like I'm gonna embrace the art and stuff like that. But Robin Williams, he embraced the art, but also he never was afraid to go back and revisit some stuff.
Oh yeah, exactly.
And, that's why I always enjoyed watching him. I mean, yes, he would do funny. He would do serious. I mean, he was all over the spectrum.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of the thing, though, too, with Fisher King. He never really revisited something like this because of one thing is the cast.
Yeah.
But also, too, the director.
Right, right.
The director is Terry Gilliam of Monty Python thing.
Right.
And Terry Gilliam has a certain way he directs. He has a certain form. He has a certain... way he rolls with things. Terry Gilliam, we'll get more into Terry Gilliam's work at the end, but to, like, throw out a random Terry Gilliam reference, The Imaginarium, Dr. Parnassus.
Oh, there you go.
Heath Ledger's final film and everything, which they were able to continue with after his passing, but they wanted to finish it for Heath. If you've seen that movie, you know what I'm talking about, how weird. It's a weird one, but
it is odd.
Beautifully done, though, too. And that's... that's the work of Terry Gilliam. And then you look at the cast.
Of course, we start with Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, he's the main lead. He mm-hmm. is Jack the radio DJ. Well, the fallen radio DJ.
Right, right. We talked about him just you know, just last episode when we talked about how he's kind of adopted this Texas twang.
Now. Yeah, he's became that actor who's basically like, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's that type of actor. He can do whatever he wants and still make it look damn good.
Exactly. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, he plays Jack, the radio DJ, the shock jock, in Made Up Howard Stern, where he gets this call-in from just a whack job, basically. But in his shock jock mentality, he brushes him off and goes, whatever, do whatever you need to do. But that leads into The Fall, which is basically this disturbed person goes into a high-end restaurant and opens fire.
Right.
Which leads into the
other character, Perry, played by Robin Williams.
Yes.
Perry is, the way I would describe him is eccentric.
Eccentric, very eccentric.
Very eccentric. Basically, he's a...
Jesus fell off the cracker?
Doesn't he believe he's a knight searching for the Holy Grail?
He's on a search for the Holy Grail. He's on a medieval quest for the... Holy Grail.
Yeah. Now
I'm repeating you.
I know you are. That's okay. But you know, that's the funny thing is, he comes across Perry when you know, Jeff, after causing this terrible thing to happen, Jack, he loses everything, doesn't he? He loses his job.
He doesn't really lose his job.
But his credibility and everything is all.
Well, his credibility goes to crap. But he just steps away because of such a traumatic thing that he. Puts the blame on himself.
Right, and he becomes suicidally despondent.
Yeah.
And he gets beaten up by a couple of muggers, and then Perry comes and helps him.
Yeah.
And that's how he meets this
guy. That's how he meets Perry. He wants to help him, but doesn't realize the full extent of his real connection to Perry until a little while into the movie. And then that leads to him really wanting to help him, but not sure... in what extreme? Because he feels like he can give him money and just brush it off. But as soon as he gives Perry the money, Perry just hands it off to another homeless person because...
Exactly, because Perry doesn't need the money.
He needs the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
And then it gives us Mercedes.
That's Jeff Bridges' love interest in this film.
Yeah, played by Mercedes Rule.
The character's name is Anne.
Anne. Played by the great Mercedes Rule. She won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress that year, too.
Oh, awesome.
And I believe the Golden Globe, too, if I'm remembering correctly. And
was this for this picture?
For Fisher King, yes.
Awesome.
Robin was nominated for
the Oscar. He was nominated for an Oscar, but...
Didn't win, but he did win the Golden Globe that year.
Well, I do love to say, you know, it's the same thing. It's an honor to be nominated. Yeah. And he certainly did.
He worked his butt off for this one.
He did. And Perry's a wonderfully relatable guy for a guy who's got the cheese slid off his cracker.
Yeah.
But that's the way Robin Williams plays his roles.
Oh, exactly. And back to Anne's character real quick. She's kind of the thing that came into Jack's life and brought him back to knowing that he has a purpose. He didn't cause that tragic circumstance, but he still doesn't let it go, but she's at least there to keep him grounded.
Exactly.
And not wanting to find a tall building.
Right. And that's what he's been, you know, kind of searching for because of the terrible fact.
Yeah, and then but the synopsis of the movie is basically we get the search for the Holy Grail in the literal sense of Perry looking for the Holy Grail. And I guess in a roundabout way, figuratively, for Jack to find the Holy Grail to find his place back in life.
Exactly. And that's a Terry Gilliam thing.
Yeah, it's a very Terry Gilliam thing because he goes different levels, different metaphors, and all that stuff. And that's
but he gets kinda, his point across.
Yeah, it's the different aspects that Terry Gilliam likes to keep it multi-layered because also, too, yes, Perry's character lost his wife in such a tragic way, but he also is looking at a female character played by Amanda Plummer, Lydia.
Lydia, yeah.
Yeah, and has feelings for her.
Yeah, yeah, and she's a bookkeeper.
Bookkeeper.
Yeah, really Millie Mousy young lady.
Eccentric on her own level.
Exactly. And one of my favorite scenes, this is a scene I still remember as a kid, is where they're sitting down, they're trying to have a date, you know, Perry's all cleaned up, he's got, you know, his hair all combed. I mean, he's still going.
Yeah, the full beard going and everything.
He's got the full beard going, but you know what? That's just Robin Williams going, I'm going to get an Oscar for this, so I wear this.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Well, it's like I've said in the past.
Just like in The Awakening, see, it's like, you know, it's going to be, it's going to be a very good role because he grew a beard.
Well, that's the whole thing. I've said it before, too. The man can grow a beard.
He can.
Yes.
And he wears them so damn well.
Oh, yeah.
If I could wear them that well, I'd probably grow
them. Another thing he wears so well, like he did in that particular scene, is the suit. The striped suit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
knowing they had the freaking pendant back on him since it was one of Jack's old suits.
Yes. That was funny.
And he sings a Charlie Chaplin song, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Yeah.
He does. He gets the whole... like crew going and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
And it's a very Terry Gilliam scene because the way it's lit and shot and everything, but also too, it's very simple just by him just wanting to sing that song.
As a filmmaker, how do you feel about like the way it was shot? I mean,
I said multiple times.
Have you seen anything like that since?
No, other Terry Gilliam's films.
Well, no, that's what I'm talking about.
But that's the whole thing. That's how we talked about like there's certain stamps that filmmakers put towards their movies.
And that's one of his.
And Terry Gilliam shoots the shit out of his scenes. And, like, you see it in Imaginarium, Dr. Parnassus. You see it in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. You see it in Brazil and all of his other movies. Even in his earliest stuff with Holy Grail. Very simple shots and everything, but still beautifully done. Like, the animation
scene. The landscapes? Landscapes that he captures in the Holy Grail?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is a basic restaurant scene that is exploded with color, with simplicity, just because of the context of the scene where he's just singing the song and they're just enjoying their time.
Mm-hmm.
In any other scene, it's just like, wow, Perry's a whack job. No, he's just wants to serenade his love.
Exactly. And it comes across very, very candid and very, very warm.
Yeah.
And also, like, she's like, embarrassed. I love this scene. Like I said, I love the scene where they're sitting together. They're trying to have a conversation and stuff like that. She's, like, spilling water and shit like that, and he's spilling water, too. He's deliberately doing it so she doesn't feel nearly as stupid. But she keeps doing stuff, and he continues doing it. By the end of it, they've kind of messed up the entire table. And I'm like, that is...
That's right.
It is. It is. It's just, it is a Robin thing.
Yeah, it's totally a Robin thing. You can almost guarantee that it was a thing he just started to roll with because it's like, you know what? He loves this girl so much, he doesn't want her to feel awkward for knocking over the drink, so he's going to knock over a drink too.
Yeah, and he has
tips over a candle. A long time, yeah. Tips over a candle.
Mm-hmm. Over a candle, she knocks over the drink, he knocks it off the table.
Yeah, exactly.
It was great.
And there's another scene that is pure Robin, and also too kind of a pure Gilliam scene because of the basicness of the scene, but how much you get from it is when Robin lets the little man out to play.
Oh, right, in the Central Park?
Yeah, the nudity in Central Park, which they literally did. Still, it's a surprising story that they were able to pull it off without having somebody show up going, like,
oh,
what
God.
The fuck is Robin Williams doing naked in the park?
Yeah, because he was completely in the buff, right?
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't even wearing, like, a long john to hover... To cover Mr. Happy?
Nope, you see it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, people were trying to throw a robe on him and everything. He's like, why? How often can I say I'm standing nude in Central Park without getting arrested? And sober.
Now that is a textbook Robin.
Yeah, he talks about dragging his ass in the grass and just loving it. Because
letting it fly.
Because it's the synopsis of the scene is that's what Barry is doing.
Do.
Is laying there cloud bursting.
Yes.
And
he says it's just a skill.
Yeah, and of course... We get Jeff Bridges going, like, what the fuck?
He's
are you
like,
doing?
I'm not doing that.
Yeah, and but.
He does it at the end.
By the end of the movie, we get it.
Yeah, we get it, and that's a nice way to wrap it up, which was really, really cool.
That we get it, and he gets it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And like you said, the figurative. Is there more we could cover on the film? Do you want me to work?
Well, there's so much to cover on the film because you get, like, the delusions of the Red Knight.
Right.
Where we know. Right off the bat, Perry has mental issues.
Exactly. I mean, he sees it. And also, the Red Knight.
Really, another...
Really wonderful spectacle to behold.
Yeah, really drawn out. Because at first, they were going to just make the Red Knight with different parts you could find laying around. It had been like car parts and stuff building this night suit. But then Terry Gilliam was like, no, we gotta go with this. Because I think it was the idea that this knight was burning from the inside out. So that's the reason the plumes of smoke... And just the demonicness of the scene. And the scene where Perry gets attacked at the end. And he goes into the coma. And Jeff Bridges is finally getting the realization of where he needs to be. What he needs to be doing. Because at that time, they did the storming of the castle.
Mm-hmm.
For the Grail and everything. And Jack decides to return to his world. And he even leaves Anne behind, which is a dick move.
Yes, that's right.
After everything this woman's done for him, he still goes, fuck it, I'm going back to Radia. But still, there's a chunk missing from him.
Right.
And we learn it's basically Perry. He leaves him in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
getting care and everything, but still...
He abandoned it.
Yeah. But then... Oh, wait. No, flip that script.
Flip it.
Yeah, sorry. Jeff Bridges is the one that gets his hands on the Grail.
Right.
Because he takes it back to Perry... Mm-hmm. Sets it down with him and is like, here you go.
The trophy.
Come back to me.
That's right. And because, he wakes up.
Yeah. He wakes up to him singing.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of what? And he realizes that Perry's okay. And then,
The thing is, he broke him out of the catatonic state because he had found the Grail.
He found the Grail. And then also too, Lydia comes in to visit him.
Mm-hmm.
And she realizes he's fine. Mm-hmm. She's freaking out. And he's like, what's wrong? I found you again. And there's... I know we...
It's a deep meaning there.
There's a lot of deep meanings towards this movie, and we only, like, scratched the surface.
Yeah, I think that's the problem when we're going on the cuff. Like I said, I'm going on the wiki link because, unfortunately,
cuff, but also, too, the aspect of the Fisher King. It is a basic story.
It is
a very basic story of a medieval mission, a personal mission, love... Honor, betrayal, comedy.
It's all there.
Mental illness. And we can go verbatim what the entire movie was about, which we kind of did.
Well, we did. It's what it is only a footnote, but the journey these characters go on is what we wanted to cover. And like I said, just because I hadn't seen it in a while doesn't mean I wouldn't recommend it. I just read the synopsis and go... Like I said, why isn't this in my video library? Because I would recommend this.
Yeah, and as we go along with all these Robin Williams movies, we're going to be going into some of them where people are probably going to be like, one-hour photo? Wasn't it just this creepy photo movie?
It's no, so we're much more than that.
Very much more than that.
Now, at least that, I've got a real solid grasp on.
Yeah.
Because I saw that one just 3 days ago.
Yeah.
But, you know, The Fisher King, we're talking something that I saw like maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So, it's there, but it's not quite up there. I could pick up scenes, but trust me, I'm pretty sure I love the movie.
Oh, yeah. We wouldn't be talking about it if we didn't love it.
Of course.
And so, as we always do with everything like this, if you have to ask yourself, why not The Fisher King, watch it.
Yes.
I'll be watching it again.
I'm trying to find it so I can watch it.
You can borrow mine.
Cool.
Okay. So, maybe we should knock some trivia out of the park on this pupper?
Yeah, like we always... pupper.
Pupper. Puppy. Pupper. It's a combination of sucker and puppy. So...
Trademark Nowhere California.
Yeah, pupper.
Pupper.
Yeah, hey, at least I didn't get totally messed up. At least it didn't sound dirty.
And you covered your base as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, my mom used to say, shoop. Oh, no, foop. She used to say foop. She says it's a combination of fuck and poop. So
when shit just doesn't work.
Exactly.
All right, so what do you got first?
Okay, the first thing I got here is this is the first film directed by Terry Gilliam to not feature any other members of the Monty Python crew.
Which is very interesting because this was in 91 and Terry Gilliam's been directing for a while.
He had.
And you think by the time this would have rolled around, because you see them playing off each other like, oh, you old fuck. Leave me alone.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Those crotchety old men.
And considering, you know, the whole Monty Python crew and everything that he had done, for him to jump to this, I think this was a breaking new ground for him in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he was taking a shot at something different. It was a different script for him, but he made it his own. Like we talked about, Terry Gilliam is a brilliant director.
Exactly, yeah. You got one?
Yeah, I got one. Howard Stern was asked for tapes of his radio show, but Howard refused and instead asked to be a consultant since they were modeling the character after him, like we were talking about earlier. There's a Howard Stern aspect to this thing. The studio didn't want to pay Stern, so they declined, and in return, Stern told them he wasn't interested in giving them the tapes. And honestly, I would almost guarantee that now Howard would probably look at it like, I should just give him the stupid tapes.
Yeah, exactly.
Because after Robin passed, I found online Howard talking about some friction, unfortunate friction that he had with Robin.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was, I forget which movie it was. And Howard being Howard, he just basically slammed it. He was like, this is stupid. I don't know why the Mork from Work guy is doing this.
Oh, wow.
And then ever since that, he was just like, oh, God, I was so stupid to do that. I was so stupid. And every off and on, he'd be like, I need to write Robin and just tell him, like, dude, I really would love to talk to you again, do an interview with you, and just talk to Robin Williams because he's always been a fan. And then the day he finally decided to sit down and write him, his wife comes in the room and tells him what happened.
Oh, my God.
And he's just like, fuck.
Oh, jeez.
So that's kind of, even, out of anybody to learn a lesson from is Howard Stern, and on that thing is you don't sit on
what your to-do list.
Yeah, or grief or gripe, and especially if you feel like it's a petty, pointless gripe.
Yeah, you think maybe that, like, Bill Murray kind of learned the similar thing with Harold Ramis?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know,
like, who was it that went to Bill saying, hey, Harold?
It was Brian. It was his brother, Brian Doyle Murray. He goes, look, this is probably the last time you're going to see him. If you have anything you want to say, you should probably say
it. You need him. You bury the hatchet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at least he got a chance to do it, and Howard unfortunately did not.
Yeah, unfortunately. But what's next up from you?
Next thing for me, this is kind of out of the blue. James Cameron was actually in serious talks to direct this movie, but he was already buried in Terminator 2.
Wow, that'd been weird.
That would have been a different kind of take.
It would have been a totally different movie.
Doesn't seem like a James Cameron film, does it?
No, it does not. And I think it would have been a detriment to the movie.
It would. I think.
As much as James Cameron is a creative visual guy.
He's good with visuals, but I don't think he would have done this justice.
The Red Knight would have been CG.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. Oh, my God. Liquid metal.
Yeah. No, he'd have been flames.
Yeah, he would.
If it was going with the whole aspect of the Red Knight being kind of burning from the inside out, he would have made him a flaming...
Love? Yeah. A flaming knight?
Yeah.
As much as I, James Cameron's great director.
Oh, yeah.
Probably not for this piece.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been right in his hands.
It's kind of like, would you want James Cameron to do Hamlet?
Oh,
I don't know, because
I did kind of raise an interesting question there.
Yeah, any director that takes on Shakespeare, it's kind of like, I want to see that. Let's see how you go. Even if it's like Kevin Smith going, I'm doing Twelfth Night. Huh?
What? Okay, you know what?
Yeah, let's see what you can do with this.
I did. That was kind of a loaded question, wasn't it? You're like, I love that, and I love the look on your face. I wish people could see it.
Yeah.
You just got this pandering look going, you know what? Yeah, I kind of do.
Yeah, we seriously need to start setting up some cameras.
We really do.
Or figuring out a video method to our madness.
Well, you know, it's just like I said, I'm conveying it as best I can. It's kind of like you've got that. And yeah, I kind of do want to see
it. Yeah, there's certain aspects when directors take on certain things, especially Shakespeare. It's like, yeah, let's see what you can pull out of your ass here.
No, exactly, yeah.
Oh, you got another one before things up, don't you?
Didn't I do the James Cameron thing?
Yeah, but you're going to talk about also, too, the movies that were inside the video store.
The front window of the video game store features a... the video store, sorry. Mm-hmm. Features a poster for director Terry Gilliam's previous film, The Adventures of Baron Von Schusen.
Yeah.
And a poster for Brazil, 1985, also directed by Gilliam, appears on the wall in the first video store scene. Almost all of the posters and videotape boxes in the video store are from RCA/Columbia Pictures. Home Video, the video arm of TriStar Pictures, which released the film. And let me go with these as well.
Well, before you get into that, that's kind of a common practice, though, too, with a lot of movies. Like, if there's a video store scene, which now... If it's a period piece, we'll get a video store scene.
Oh, geez. No kidding. You don't get that now.
Yeah, that's going to be the kind of thing. If we ever do make films or whatever, it's going to be like, I want to put a video store in there. But that was the standard rule of practice. Like, whenever you saw, like, a video store or anything like that, like, in Jersey Girl, you listen to the commentary of Jersey Girl. When they're in the video store, Kevin Smith's talking about how all the Miramax movies that are there.
I know.
And that's the rule of thumb is, like, you're not really going to see Miramax movies and a Warner Brothers movie.
I think that's funny. I guess that kind of says, I mean, maybe this is like pointless trivia. It's kind of like how...
No, it's a lost piece of trivia because, like I said, video stores are gone.
Well, they are now, yeah. It's a shame, but yeah, I remember when they were, when they do have that, they're associated with the property or with the studio. It's like, hey, let's pump these movies. I mean, if we're going to have the scene, it's like, well, sometimes I will be seeing a movie that could be terrible, and say it takes place at a video store, and I am coming across stuff, God, I really wish I was watching that movie. I mean...
Or, also, too, kind of the rule of thumb is, too, if it's, like, movies that are not part of that studio's canon, you'll see the movies flipped over.
Oh, right!
Yeah.
Right, like, you'll just see the actor. It's kind of like...
Just get the words.
You got Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, in a video store, and look, there's Commando. But no, they'll just superimpose Sylvester Stallone on it or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they
there's tricks to the trade, but there's actually a list of what was appearing in the store.
Oh, yeah, I have to bring this up, because, it has my favorite movie and yours. In Ann's video store, VHS copies of the following films... Oh, VHS. Oh, God. Sorry, I had to stop.
That's a dead art form.
I had to stop for a second.
Got to get nostalgic there.
Do you remember vinyl? Yeah. Okay. Films can be seen on display. The Toy. Head.
Hey, mainstream slavery.
Yeah. Head.
Oh, yes, Head.
Yeah, Cyclone. Real Genius. Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters 2. Both of them, baby! Both of them! Hot Stuff, Hanky Panky, The Jill Olsen Story, Bye Bye Birdie, Funny Girl, Funny Lady, the Stephen Littlefoys, My Demon Lover, Happy New Year, The Big Heat, Bless the Beasts and Children, California Sweet, Shalom? S-A-L-O-M-E? Probably Shalom.
We'll just go with that.
Ah, my bad. Gregory Girl, Tommy, Jolson Sings Again, Carmen... A Song to Remember, Affair in Trinityland, Angels Over Broadway, Road to Rio, Loving You, and You'll Never Get Rich.
Yeah, and you look at those two, yes, they're probably part of that video arm of that studio, but also, too, those are probably a lot of Terry Gilliam favorites, too.
I think they are. They're probably... You know what? I think it's probably just a subtle recommendation list.
Yeah, it's like, hey, look at these.
Hey, if you love these, that's what it is. Because, you know, I'm looking at them, right?
Yeah.
And even all the ones that I know of, none of them are stinkers.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're not crap.
Oh.
I mean, I have seen people where, like, you see Howard the Duck in the back. Now, I personally don't think Howard the Duck is crap.
You know me.
But you know how panned it is by... you know, critics and maybe the casual viewer.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what the fuck was that? But Howard the Duck will probably be getting his own movie really soon.
Oh, yeah. So. Or you're going to see more of Howard the Duck show up in backgrounds because now it's...
It's a thing.
It's a hipster thing now going, oh, hey, yeah. You saw Guardians of the Galaxy. Let's see the original...
I think Howard the Duck was probably now going to get a Blu-ray because of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, I hope so. That'd be awesome. It deserves one.
It does. Was that my big one? Is that my closing?
I think so, because the next one I got is kind of a big one, too.
Oh, can I throw this one out before you finish?
Yeah, yeah.
One of the men who attacks Jeff Bridges early in the film...
Oh, I almost forgot about this one.
It's okay, is played by Dan Fireman, who plays Robin Williams' son in The Birdcage.
Which is a cool little piece of trivia.
It is!
Because I wonder if they remembered each other.
That's what I was wondering, and he would have been a lot younger at this. I mean, this is when he would be an upcomer, and he's like, oh, I'm thug number five, and I'm beating the shit out of Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams.
But also, the flip of the coin on that, maybe Robin recommended him for The Birdcage.
It could have been! You know, they could have been buddies on the... The thing is, anybody... I have heard some great stories, and I think...
Well, the story that comes to mind right now is Thud from Hook.
Talking
to Robin about, I want to do this short about Hook and everything. Do you want to be in it? And he's like, yeah, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The big guy, right?
Yeah, yeah, Thud.
Yeah, Thud, yeah. Big, big, wonderful guy.
Yeah.
The fact that Robin Williams was ready to back that project.
He jumped right in.
He's down for it. As a matter of fact, I think, he knows a good project. I mean, I don't think Matt... Oh, you know what? I don't think we'd have Ben Affleck as Batman if not for the influence of Robin Williams.
That is very true.
Because that's the gateway. Granted, we had Ben Affleck, doing thing, but Ben Affleck's first really straight role was opposite Matt Damon, where he wasn't just this goofball.
Yeah.
He was Matt Damon's buddy in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, exactly.
And it kind of showed, oh yeah, here he is with his Boston accent and stuff like that, but he became, kind of one of those guys who's like, you like to see him.
Well, that's the whole thing, too. When it comes down to it, like, Matt and Ben, when Robin passed and everything, they fly outside and they'll still say, it's like, Robin got Good Will Hunting made.
Yes.
If they weren't able to get Robin into Good Will Hunting, the studio would have been like, no, you don't have a big name, so we're not going to push it as much as we would with a big name as Robin Williams.
Yeah, and they were pals ever since.
Yeah, oh, yeah, exactly.
And that's what I think is awesome. And that's how down-to-earth Robin Williams was. He probably did recommend him for The Birdcage. It's like, remember talking to this up-and-coming actor? I mean,
in an audition going, like, he probably maybe even went for an audition, and Robin's probably like, do you kick my ass in a movie before?
Yeah, exactly. There's many things that Robin Williams...
There are so many stories we can fill in the gaps with our own take.
Oh, you can imagine, because the thing is, children who work with them... Everybody says the same thing. The children's and adult alike, they love working with Robin Williams.
Exactly.
And Robin Williams just loved working with them. That's the power of Robin Williams.
Exactly. And to finish up our trivia,
the trivia
section for right now, my final piece of trivia is a very grand scene. And like how we talked about the way Terry Gilliam shoots his scenes and everything, this kind of tells you a lot. The scene where it's the waltzing commuters, where everything kind of just goes into that dreamlike state of everybody that's going through the Grand Central Station just starts doing the waltz as Robin and Lydia are meeting up. For the waltzing commuter scene in Grand Central Station, the main hall for the terminal was shut down for the shoot from 8 p.m. until the first commuter trains arrived at 5 in the morning the next morning.
Wow.
That tells you a lot about, like, filmmaking in general. They do this a lot. It's a night shoot. They'll work their way around it.
They're trying to make the illusion there.
Yeah, because the lighting effects outside of the large terminal windows made it seem like 5 in the evening for the entire night, and over 400 extras waltzed around the mirrored ball top information booth again and again throughout the night. And kind of a cool thing, too, is on New Year's Eve now, an orchestra plays there and people waltz for real. It becomes a party.
It's a thing. That's actually very, very magical what that's done.
Yeah.
And not to mention, I bet you that is probably one of the most complicated shots in the film.
Dance sequences are insane.
They are.
Especially that
they
one.
Are. And I can say this now, I've been on sets, probably nothing this complex, but you can just kind of imagine, the take after take and trying to get that rolling and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. It's like Kevin Smith during the making of Clerks 2 when they were doing the dance sequence outside the movies.
Right.
He was like, I always wanted to do a dance sequence and everything. And after doing this scene, I don't want to do one ever again. I got it out of my system.
Well, good for him.
Because it's such an undertaking.
It is.
And but that waltzing commuter scene is beautiful.
It's beautifully shot.
It's been a while since we actually have done a like full blown Why Not, and especially after the passing of Robin, we knew we were going to do this full year of Robin Williams Why Nots. So as you're probably sitting there thinking, well, are you going to do the rapid fire Robin Williams thing again? No. Don't jump before the horse, people.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a look at more of the works of the director of Terry Gilliam.
Yeah.
And his past works, like I said, and I'm stumbling on my words already.
That's right. It's okay.
Anyways, we're going to talk about just some of our favorites of the Terry Gilliam canon. So, Phil, go first.
Oh, okay. Do I say one and you go, or do I just...
We'll go rapid fire. We'll go back and forth.
Okay. I would say Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Classic.
Oh, absolutely.
Look,
you stupid bastard. You got no bloody arms left. I mean, it's great.
I'll admit, I went and saw it during Classic Showcase because I never saw it,
but that's the way to see it. How?
I didn't understand it.
You're not supposed to, really.
Yeah. Well, I got to the end. I'm like, that's it?
Oh, okay. And they just get arrested?
Yeah. but also, too, me being me, I'm like, okay, I get it, and I don't care.
That's...
I understand the Monty Python world.
Don't feel bad. That's
probably a lot of people.
That's the norm there.
And yeah, but I think Holy Grail is a classic. It is a beautifully done movie.
That's the one that they always showed in the 1990s. They always showed Monty Python the Holy Grail on Comedy Central. That was their golden child.
Yeah, that was their go-to movie.
I love that.
Yeah, and it's weird. I never watched it when it was on Comedy Central. It took me until like recently to see it.
Well, you need to see it uncensored because I mean
you're missing a lot when it's censored.
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Okay. So my first one out of the canon will be one we kind of mentioned during this episode: The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Right. Very twisted.
Very twisted, but also too, if you know and understand the backstory of how this movie got made, because Heath Ledger was supposed to be throughout the entire movie.
I know, and he passed.
Then he passed away, and luckily, one, Terry Gilliam was almost ready to scrap because it was Heath Ledger, but then also too, he got an idea to bring in Colin Farrell, Johnny Depp, and Jude Law.
Yeah.
And then one of the really cool things about it too is Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell.
They all dedicated their salaries to his daughter.
And they just did it to finish the work for their friend.
That was good.
And it's beautifully done. It's a weird acid trip of a movie, which falls short for a lot of people because you get to the really weird stuff.
But it's a miracle it got completed.
It's a miracle it got completed, and it deserved to get completed because it was really great story.
It was.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
And
That shows the strength of Terry Gilliam.
The next one on mine is Time Bandits. Another classic.
Yes. Big time. Is that basically it? That's a mic drop? It's like Time Bandits.
Time Bandits. That's it.
That's all I gotta say.
What more do I have to say? It's Time Bandits. Period. Yeah.
Next one for me is 12 Monkeys.
Very good.
The Bruce Willis, Brad Pitt movie, which got Brad Pitt an Oscar win, I believe, if I remember correctly. But another really twisted movie where you got to make sure you're paying attention every little bit, because when the end is revealed, you're like, I got to sit through this movie again.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I got to see where there's those little sprinkling of Easter eggs throughout the movie where it's like, this is where it's leading, this is where it's leading, and then you get the reveal and you're like, oh.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm leaving it kind of vague because if, honestly, you have not seen 12 Monkeys, go.
Yeah.
Watch it now.
There's another Why Not for you.
Yes.
Now, this one I'm throwing out as a recommendation. Now, I haven't seen it, but it's a recommendation also for myself. The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Well, you talked about it a little bit, too.
I talked about it a little bit because I'd seen the trailers and stuff like that with the clamshell lady. Hello.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, I now know where those tropes came from when they are being satired on TV. I saw the satires way before I actually saw the actual movie. So see, I'm not without shame.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And but in all fairness, I can't find this sucker.
Oh, it's a hard one to find.
If I could find this sucker on DVD, I would have gotten it already.
It's out of the mainstream. And yeah, I talk shame among myself, but I'm a sadomasochist when it comes to that. Where it's like, I should watch it.
I should watch it. I know. You still ask for it, and I still give you certain shit for a lot of things. Yeah. Like, how do you not even see this by accident? I'll still do that to you.
Oh, yeah, because I call for it.
I know.
To wrap up my recommendations, because I got three, and I know you have one more after this.
I do, but that's all right.
Is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Now, that one's funky. Another interesting shot is with all those Elvises parachuting out the...
No, that's not Fear
and Loathing. Oh, that's not Fear and Loathing. Oh, no, no.
That's Honeymoon in Vegas.
Sorry, that's Leaving Las Vegas. Sorry.
No, that's Honeymoon in Vegas.
Honeymoon in Vegas? No.
Yeah, Leaving Las Vegas is where Nicolas Cage is drinking himself to death.
That's the one. Leaving Las Vegas.
There's no parachuting Elvises in Leaving Las Vegas.
Are you sure?
I am sure. There's parachuting Elvises in Honeymoon in Vegas with Nicolas Cage.
No, they get Nicolas Cage. That's the
one. Yeah. Well, you got your Nicolas Cage Vegas movies mixed up.
I sure did.
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
trust me, we're not going over the mask.
No, I'm not. No, I was following you. I'm only. Oh shit! Where did I trip?
The trains were colliding.
No. It's okay. I was going. Okay, where did I trip?
Yeah.
You know. So, and I did. But
Nicolas Cage was your trip.
Nicolas Cage was there. Yeah, it was Nicolas Cage. Okay, but Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. That's Johnny Depp.
That's Johnny Depp. Benicio del Toro, the film adaptation of the Hunter S. Thompson novel, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which. I read the book after I saw the movie, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
He did it pretty well, but it's also, too, this is a gonzo thing to
now,
try
to... Now, that one's another freaking acid trip, but...
And I know there's other directors, because I've listened to the commentary multiple times on this one, and they talked, like, one of the producers talked about how many different directors were in line to make this movie, but mm-hmm. Terry Gilliam was the only one that would be able to do it justice.
Oh, absolutely.
Doing, like, the drug scenes, the lizard people in the lounge.
Oh, my God, that was funny. It was a fucking buffet, you know?
Yeah, and be able to talk Johnny Depp into going that deep in the role. Talking Benicio del Toro to jump that big. Because you
seen... And Tobey Maguire before he was Spider-Man.
Yeah, well, all the people that did guest stars spots in that. Like, Benicio del Toro, you see him now as, like, this good-looking, handsome guy.
Yeah.
Plays a freaking Fat Samoan in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
I know.
And, yeah, it's a crazy freaking trip, and... To quote Hunter S. Thompson, if you have not seen it, buy the ticket, take the ride, because Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is one you have to experience.
Yeah, see, I've only seen bits of.
Yeah.
But I could look at Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and look at the Imaginarium and see how they're related.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, those guys are cousins.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, with less drug influence on Imaginarium.
Quite a bit. But, you know, but I will not deny that they're visually captivating.
Oh, very, very.
Let's see. Well, the one that I threw in... Oh, here's one for you. Now, this one's a mindfuck, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily a really good story, but this is the Brothers Grimm. Really interesting take on the Grimm brothers.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite parts is I like this little mud monkey thing that turns into the gingerbread man. I taste good! Because it takes... Yeah, it takes, like, the mouth and eyes off this child, and it's able to speak itself, and it is a weird monstrosity, monstrous creation, and it's only on the, it's only in frame for, like, 6 minutes.
Yeah.
But it's funny to watch, and the characters themselves are twisted, and you got both Heath Ledger and Matt Damon in the film. Like I said, not their best work, and not... not Terry Gilliam's best, but I'd say give it a look if you want a good laugh.
Well, that's the whole thing, too. It may not be one of their best works, but also, too, they may have got the script and, like, Terry Gilliam probably got the script first and was like, really?
Mm-hmm.
And then was like, okay, I'll do what I can with it. And then Heath Ledger and Matt Damon probably got word that Terry Gilliam was doing the movie, and they're mm-hmm. like, we're in.
I'm not saying they didn't try.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure in somebody else's hands, this could have been a real piece of shit.
Oh, exactly.
Is all I'm saying. The thing is, it's got some value in being watched as it is. I don't think anybody else could have taken this script and done with it what Terry Gilliam did with it.
Exactly.
And that's kind of like you said, like if James Cameron got it, I don't think it would have been that good.
No. And that is a good way to wrap things up because, like, with this being our first Robin Why Not with the Fisher King and everything, there's a lot of Why Nots here. It's like... If you haven't seen Fisher King, why not? If there's, like, the Terry Gilliam movies we've mentioned, if you haven't seen them, why not? And just simply, you can't why a movie, you just gotta why not.